20th Radio.
You're listening to Frontiers Radio, a podcast for psychotherapists who value deep learning and individualized development. On the show, you acquire cutting-edge knowledge that pushes beyond the edge of your development. Deliberate practice principles are pulled together from the studies of expertise and expert performance in a variety of professional domains, including cognitive sciences about how we learn, behavioral economics, aesthetic arts, and of course, from the front lines of psychotherapy research. It's my job to help you stay at the bleeding edge so that your clients reap the benefits as you become a deep learner. So we have two kids, and six and two, and you would know that if you've got two kids in the car, it's not the cleanest place. So my task was that I'm going to clean the car. I'm going to make sure that it's as spick and span as possible. So I whipped out the vacuum cleaner, a Dyson vacuum cleaner that my wife had bought, and set myself afoot to the garage and to clean up the car. Truthfully, I was torn with wasting my time with such a frivolous activity. But, you know, I went on. I turned on this cordless vacuum cleaner, and I went ahead, cleaned and cleaned and cleaned. I removed the car seats. I removed all the leg paddings and whatnot and kept going. And to be honest, it wasn't the progress that I was seeing that was making me go on, but it was when I stopped and when I looked into the vacuum cleaner. And if you know about Dyson's vacuum cleaners, they are not only backless, but you can see the shit that it cleans up, the stuff that's in there. And, you know, strangely, it was a really good feeling to see that it was sucking up all this dirt into this machine. James Dyson went through over 5,000 prototypes of his cyclone-based vacuum cleaner before he developed the first successful model. Still, no manufacturing company in the US and the UK was initially willing to license his product. I mean, today, Dyson, the company, has a profit returns of over $500 million in annual profits and employs nearly 7,000 people worldwide. Had the founder given up on his quest for a backless vacuum, I mean, Dyson would just be another name, another vacuum cleaner. See, the thing was, it wasn't just backless. It was visible progress. Users literally could not see what had been sucked into the machines until they emptied their filled bags. So Dyson decided that he would design a user experience guaranteed to show customers how well the cyclone technology works. He made the chambers of his vacuum cleaner transparent. James Dyson goes on to say, "The interesting thing is that when I did this, all our competitors just fell over the floor laughing. They were actually delighted that I'd been so stupid," as he recalls in an interview. "And the retailers wouldn't have it. We went into the stores and our vacuum had all this shit in it. The retailers are absolutely hostile. They said, no. It's a complete mistake. Make it smoked or tinted or something." But James Dyson persisted. He found it really fascinating that you could see what's really happening, to see the nature and the texture and type of dirt that was picking up, the very experience I was having just cleaning up the car. What did this micro-innovation ask customers to do? Michael Schrange, who said in his book, "Who Do You Want Your Customers to Become?" said, "What did this micro-innovation of James Dyson ask customers to do? It asked them to take a good look." Now that's genius. And I think it's important that we learn to make progress of any kind that we're doing visible. Whether is it in therapy, when you're working with your clients, to make sure that you find a way, figure out a way that you can graph the progress and make it visible not only to yourself as a treating therapist, but also to your clients. On a therapist level, make what you're trying to do visible to yourself, whether is it a note that's stuck in front of your office wall or a calendar reminder that pops up to remind what you're trying to work on to improve. These things help because visible progress reinforces the feedback loop to carry on. It gives you a sense of achievement, accomplishment. It gives you a sense that, yes, my foot is on the ground and it's propelling me forward. With the lack of progress comes ambiguity, uncertainty, not knowing what's going. I'm pretty sure that if I was just cleaning up the car without seeing some sign of progress, even though I could see the car's cleaner, it wouldn't feel like where the dirt has gone until I see it. Until I see it, then it gets visceral because what is visible becomes visceral. So think about your practice right now. If you are wondering what I need to do to get clear on my growth edge, what do I need to work on, write to us. Take a look at a blog post called Mastery Learning, and we're going to talk a bit more about this in our forthcoming book, a book that Scott Miller, Mark Hubble, and I are doing called Better Results. We're going to expound on the topic that we use in a worksheet called Taxonomy of Deliberate Practice Activities, TDPA. It's designed to help supervisors and therapists identify their growth edge and what to work on that has leverage on their outcomes. And also, progress can be made visible when you're using outcome measures one session at a time, measuring things as of value to your client. Rather than valuing whatever you're told to measure, take the time to consider what are important things that we need to be measuring so that we can feed that back to our clients and reinforce the progress. Progress made visible is not a new idea. In fact, you see this almost every day. When you're filling up a form, there'll be a bar that shows you how long it takes before completion. We are told that seeing such progress gives you a sense of less uncertainty, more of a sense of control of what's going on. In fact, the London train improved customer satisfaction not just by introducing more frequent trains, which cost huge amounts of money. What they did was just introduce the use of dot metrics displays of remaining time left before the train arrives. And you would see this in most cities now where it shows the amount of time remaining. Or even when you order a pizza. When you order pizza, they will show you the step-by-step creation of the pizza process. Now, I'm not sure if that really is true, but genius, because it gives you an idea of how much time to expect before you see the hot piping pizza box in front of your house with somebody knocking at your door for delivery. And Korea has also designed a really interesting experiment when they install timers on their traffic light system for vehicles. So what they did was in the stop sign, the red light, they had the timer going around the clock to show that as the time winds in the red light around the circle, it just means that it is the amount of time left before it's turning green. Now, having that reduce accident rates. And they did a slightly devious experiment when they did for the green lights as well. And turns out that's not such a good idea because when people saw that the green light was running out of time, people sped even faster to kind of break, to kind of cut through before it turns red. But certainly showing the amount of progress, the amount of time left gives the person a sense of less ambiguity, more of a sense of progress. Now, closer to home, Jeb Brown has done a really interesting study in the ACON collaboration where they looked at the amount of time that therapists not only just use routine outcomes, but the amount of time they engage in monitoring their progress when they locked onto the system to look at where they stand in terms of their effectiveness, where they stand in terms of their progress. And it turns out that therapists who engage more in monitoring their outcomes, making the progress visible to themselves, predicted better outcomes than the average therapist. More on this in the show notes, and you can look at Jeb Brown's study on this. Thank you for sending in your questions to the Frontiers Radio. I love to hear from you, and it's always interesting to hear people's journeys and their struggles, as well as their successes and stuff that they come up with. This time around, I invite you to send in your voice memo of a question that you have related to your development, your individualized development, be it stuff that you're facing with or struggles that you're experiencing, that maybe you could send in a question to us so that we all can benefit from hearing from you. Now, I've got quite a bit of questions that come in from email. Well, it would be super cool if we could hear from you on a voice memo as well. So just take a smartphone and record your questions and send them over to me through my email, which is info@darylchow.com, info@darylchow.com. So without further ado, let's hear our first question from Mr. Ben Feynman.
Hey, Daryl, this is Ben Feynman. Checking in from Los Angeles. My question relates to how to engage with a lot of the ideas that you talk about on this podcast, the things you and your colleagues have written about in the past, in spaces that aren't necessarily supportive of those ideas. So specifically, I'm finishing up my graduate education, and I'm still a trainee doing my clinical work. And I find that a lot of times when I bring up like the kind of topics that you write about, like deliberate practice, routine outcome monitoring, etc., I'm met with sometimes skepticism or at worst, even hostility from people who have like a one-up position of power over me. And so I find it at times challenging to know how to proceed in incorporating a lot of the things that you talk about in environments where I am a student or a trainee or a supervisee, and those ideas aren't necessarily supported. So just curious about your perspective about that and any advice you might have for me or other people in similar environments. Thanks, Daryl. Keep up the good work.
The question that Ben raises is an important one, especially when you are a student or when you are in the midst of your early career trying to develop and seeking guidance from other people in your work. I remember a saying by the Japanese writer Haruki Murakami on kindness and disagreement, and this is what Haruki would say. Always remember that to argue and to win is to break down the reality of the person you are arguing against. It is painful to lose your reality. So be kind, even if you are right. I recall in my master's program, I was in a group psychotherapy module, and I happened to chance upon a book, and another book other than the text. And this was also on group psychotherapy by Irvin Yalom. And I brought this to the class and wanted to discuss this with my lecturer at that time. And she said to me to just follow the text. Don't, you know, stretch out too much because it's going to confuse you. I was rather disappointed because it gave me an indication of how open she was to instill or inculcate other perspectives. A couple of months ago, I was preparing for a web-based workshop that I was designing called The Deep Learner. I chanced upon this book by Brian Kaplan, an economist, and the book title was The Case Against Education, Why the Education System is a Waste of Time and Money. It's a rather provocative title. But in one of the chapters, he draws a distinction between sculptors and appraisers. And here's Kaplan. By analogy, both sculptors and appraisers have the power to raise the market value of a piece of stone. The sculptor raises the market value of a piece of stone by shaping it. The appraiser raises the market value of a piece of stone by judging it. Teachers need to ask ourselves, how much of what we do is sculpting and how much is appraising? And if we won't ask ourselves, our alumni needs to ask for us. So we're faced with reality, which is some of our experience in education is more of an appraising situation, others more like sculpting, and probably the majority of us would face a mix of both. And here lies the tension. What are we to do when we are in an education system that's focused on appraising, that we don't feel sculpted, we don't feel guided by what the cutting-edge literature is saying, or if the school is trying to promote a particular way of thinking, or even using the umbrella of what evidence-based practice is about, that they have to do particular prescribed types of treatment? So I have a few points to bring up and for us to think about what Ben is raising in his question. And the first point I would like to raise is that we do need to take charge of our own development. We need to guide our way along this journey. We need to figure out what truly self-directed learning is about so that we could learn what we can within the education system, get through the registration and license that we need to become a practitioner, but also to remember that that's just the beginning. That's just the beginning. We have a journey ahead, and what we need to start to do is to figure out where we're at in the scheme of things. Maybe even start to make sure that in your practicums and your internships that you're using some form of measures so that you can develop your baseline at the beginning of your career. The second point I would like to raise is that please seek out others around the world, connect with people who are also in the same type of situation. If you can find people locally, that would be great to band together. If not, join the Center of Clinical Excellence to look to connect with other people who are also in this path of figuring out where they can develop and where they can grow as practitioners. I would add that the role of the clinical supervisor is critical in this piece, because the supervisor is the one right in the middle who is guiding, who is leading and helping the therapist in their developmental efforts, which is why I've developed the Reigniting Clinical Supervision web-based course that's designed specifically for supervisors to coach therapists, not just with their stuck cases, but also to help therapists in their development and play the long game. So reach out to supervisors who know what you're talking about, who are invested not in just a particular therapy, but who are invested in the therapists. Third, I would say that we are at the wet edge of the paint, at the wet edge of the paint. So have compassion for others who do not see what you see, because this is all very recent unfoldings, and we're all just trying to figure out a way to get better as therapists. You know, one of the reasons I really enjoy working with therapists is because many therapists come into the profession, the majority of therapists who come into the profession have a caring heart. They want to help. They want to reach out to people. And some of us have gone through our own inner wounds as well and know what that is like. So there is a certain level of dignity and compassion that people would want to have. But the methods that we take may differ. Our views, our metaphors that we choose may differ. And the moment that you sense where certain situations get dogmatic, that's when you want to just thread lightly, have kindness, because for some people, my view is that when they hold an idea pretty heavily is because that gives them a sense of structure, a sense of vessel, a way to contain what they're doing. I'd like to bring up what St. Thomas Aquinas would say. Look for disagreements, because that's when iron sharpens iron, where that we start to try to hold our view and that of the other person and to see where is the gap, where is the bridge that we can link and have a deeper conversation and to take it one step further to see if we have missed stuff, if there are things that we can learn from each other. Now, granted, as students, with your teachers, your lecturers or professors, you're dealing with that power dynamics that's going to be a struggle, as I've faced in my higher education experience. In case you're also interested, you might want to look at the Frontiers blog, and there's a theme called Reimagine Education and Psychotherapy, REP. If you go to darylchow.com/frontiers, You can look at the column in the menu bar under the themes of reimagined psychotherapists, or rather reimagined education in psychotherapy. And here's one final thing to remember. The word culture. Culture, from Latin, it is root word, means to care. To care. And I think if we give care to this evolution that we are facing, we want to create a culture not just from top down, but also bottom up. We want to create a culture that's going in the right direction. I think there is going to be a sea change. There's a movement going on to refocus on how we can reimagine our development and not just get too caught up with our dogmas about views and different schools of approaches. I think we've come to, or at least we're coming to, a turning point in this. We have to come together. We need to find ways to talk about this, discuss about this, and treat psychotherapy, the practice of psychotherapy, less of an individual sport and more of a team sport. And before I forget, Ben Feynman, the person you heard in the question, is a co-host with Carrie Witter of the Very Bad Therapy podcast. And really thank you for sending in that question. And check out their podcast, the Very Bad Therapy podcast is super interesting. You get to hear from clients who've experienced horrendous, if not shocking, types of therapy experiences. And they unpack that with Ben and Carrie. And also professionals come in to lend in their voice to kind of unpack and deconstruct what was happening and to make sense of all of that. You might also want to check out the podcast, The Modern Therapist Survival Guide with Kurt Whitholm and Katie Vernon, and they feature Ben and Carrie in this episode called The Unlearning Very Bad Therapy. Unlearning Very Bad Therapy. And they interview both of them and they talk about the struggles as students as well as what you heard from Ben. And they shared about how they deal with the struggles and how they came together, how they started the podcast. Really interesting. So please check them out. Frontiers Radio. This is Frontiers Radio, or rather, the official name is Frontiers of Psychotherapist Development Podcast. Remember to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts, be it Spotify, Stitcher, Google, or Apple. And if you wish, drop us a voice memo. I would love to hear from you if you have questions about our professional development. And you can take a phone and record down your question and send it to me at info@darylchyle.com. That's info@darylchow.com. Thanks for listening.